this way. Keep moving on, keep moving on. Every day. Keep moving on, keep moving on. Life is this way. Trying to recall the things I've done and debts I have to pay. For there is one thing that I know, what you reap is what you sow. Keep moving on, keep moving on. Life is this way, so keep moving on, keep moving on. Every day. Brother, mind out what you do and how you treat your fellow man. If you knew like me, you'd try and live the very best you can. For if you spread good all around, you'll be able to sleep when the sun goes down. Keep moving on, keep moving on. Life is this way, so keep moving on, keep moving on. Every day.
The man, do you see these tears here in my eyes? Well, ain't no use in me lying, cause I really cry. You think you're gonna take me and put me on the shelf? Girl, I'd rather die than see you with somebody else. So throw it out of your mind. I'll never leave
no matter how.
Though you grieve me and deceive me, mama, yeah.
So don't you think of me.
Hey, don't you understand what you're doing to the man? You're using me like a carpenter uses a tool. And I know their intentions are all very good. Some of them would help me if they could. But I'm
never gonna give you up.
Never, 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 never.
No matter how you treat me,
no matter what you say, no.
So don't you think of me.
Hey, don't you understand? Killing this man.
Troubling
somebody would come and ease my troubling mind. Oh, yes, I do. Why won't somebody come and ease my troubling mind? I sure wish somebody would come and ease my troubling mind. Oh, yes, I do. I wish my baby would come and tell me everything's all right. My baby would come and tell me everything is still alright. Oh, yes, I do. They tell me when you tell somebody your troubles, trouble fly away from you. I'm looking for somebody I can tell my troubles to. Why won't somebody come and ease my troubling mind? Yeah. I sure wish somebody
And you are listening to CKLN. This is Saturday Morning Live, and we are doing our thing. We're at 11:30. We're going to be speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn. At 12 o'clock, we're going to have on Bob Davis of Soul Patrol. And Saturday Morning Live continues with another musical interlude.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times that I thought I could last for long, but now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
Thank you. sin to all mankind. Understanding and peace in mind. But if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Someone to love. Show the world how to get along. Peace will enter when the hate is gone. But if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Please send me someone to love. I lay awake nights and ponder world troubles, and my answer is always the same. That unless man put an end to this damnable sin, hate will put the world in a flame. What a shame. Just because I'm in misery, I don't beg for no sympathy. But if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Please send me someone to love. Just because I'm in misery, I don't beg for no sympathy. But if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Please send me someone to love.
And you are listening to CKLN. This is Saturday Morning Live, not Saturday Morning Jive. And we are going to be speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn at 11:30. And we're going to be speaking with Bob Davis of Soul Patrol at high noon. This is June. We are in the month of June, and June is Black Music Month.
Hey, and this is Melinda. I just wanted to shout out an event that's happening on the island. It looks pretty dope. It's 12 hours from 12 p.m. to 12 a.m. And it's called 88 Days Presents Wilding on the Island. There's lineups all day. There's music, live painting, workshops, sky installations, photo booth, food, performances, including local performers such as Ian Kamau, Lull, Shy Wisdom, Unknown Misery, and many, many more. So check that out. There's shuttle buses actually leaving from Hanlon's Point and catch the ferry. Or actually, you could just walk there when you get to the island. But there's shuttle buses leaving from 11:45 to 15. And they're all throughout the day. So check that out. It starts at noon and it goes all the way to midnight. Yeah, that's all. I just wanted to announce that.
And you're listening to CKLN. This is Saturday Morning Live. And C.L.R. James wrote that had the mighty sparrow or slinger Francisco, who was born in Grenada, went to the United States, he may have been as big as Brooke Benton, Sam Cooke, or some of the other R&B singers. And the Mighty Sparrow did a couple of ballads, and when he is on stage, he does this song every show he does. The last time I saw him at the, I think it was the Ontario Science Center on Don Mills Road, he sang this song, Only a Fool Breaks His Own Heart. Oh.
Why do I keep fooling myself when I know you love someone else? Only a fool breaks his own heart. I pretend that I don't see when you walk Only a fool breaks his own heart. I have to admit it, even though you hurt me so, girl, I can't forget it if I'm a man. I'd let you go, it's no use trying to hang on to a love already gone. Only a fool breaks his own heart. I have to admit it, even though you hurt me so, girl, I can't forget it. If I'm a man, I'd let you go. It's no use trying to hang on to a love already gone. Only a fool breaks his own heart. Only a fool breaks his own heart.
only a fool breaks his heart.
Wish I knew why I'm so in love with you. No one else in this world will do. Darling, please save your love for me. Run away. If I were wise, I'd run away. But like a fool in love, I stay and pray you'll save your love for me. I can feel it even when you're not here. Can't conceal it, I really love you, my dear. And though I know no good can come from loving you, I can't do a thing. Oh, I'm so in love with you. So darling, mercy on a fool like me. I know I'm lost, but still I plead. Darling, please save your love for me. You may have fun with the crowd, but for crying out loud, darling, please save your love for me.
Nancy Wilson on CKLN, and in a few moments we're going to be speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn. And this is Saturday Morning Live, and June is Black Music Month.
Your letter, baby, I was in a foxhole on my knees. Oh yes, I was. And your letter brought me so much strength. Tell you what I did, baby. You won't believe it. I raised up and got me two more enemies. Oh yes, I did. Listen, that's why I believe that I'm gonna make it. Tell everybody back home, I believe that I'm gonna make it. And baby, I'll be home before you can say it. Jackie Robinson, oh yes, I will. Yes, yes, I will. Sometimes I wonder, do you really love me? Then I think of something sweet you once said to me. And the thought makes me feel so good inside. I raise up and get me two more enemies. Oh, yes, I do. Wished a thousand times that we had gotten married before I left home for Vietnam. But then when I see so many of my buddies getting shot down all around me, makes me kind of glad that we waited, because I don't want to leave you at home being a widow and all. I know you understand, baby. Listen, darling, they're probably
promised me a furlough on the 15th of next month. And I want you to say a prayer tonight that my furlough will come through so I can come home to be with you. And tomorrow, go by and tell my mom and daddy that I love them and for them not to worry about me. Listen, cause I believe.
Never, never will I wed. Born to wander solitary, wide my world, narrow my bed. Never, never, never will I marry. Born to wander till I'm dead. No burdens to bear, no conscience nor care, no memories to
You're listening to CKLN, and that was Nancy Wilson. They used to call her the baby, and she was performing with Nat Adderley, Cannonball Adderley, and I think Joe Zavenu was a part of that group, and she did a song called Never Never Will I Marry, and I think that's from Nancy's second album. And we are getting ready to talk to Dr. Gerald Horn. Are you there, good doctor?
Yes, sir.
And how is everything going? How is your day going today?
Well, I'm in New York, and it's cool and drizzly. How about you?
It is. It was kind of drizzly here, and kind of Ugandish type weather. It's kind of perfect out there. It's nice, you know. It's You can walk around with a t-shirt on if you wish. I have on just a shirt, but it's I think as Gil Scott-Heron quoting Bill Withers. It's a lovely day.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the first thing we wanted to talk about was there are elections taking place in Peru, also elections taking place in Turkey. And I know that you talk a lot about elections, so let's start with the elections in those two, one country in South America and Turkey. Could you talk about Turkey when you answer the question? Turkey is... have they made up their mind? Are they in Europe, the Middle East, or where is Turkey supposedly now?
Well, it's the bridge between Europe and Asia, and of course it borders Syria, and there hangs a tail, which mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Right.
Elections are tomorrow. The AKP party, which is the way it's described in the North Atlantic, it's also described as a mildly Islamicist party, led by President Erdogan, is expected to do quite well. Certainly there has been a major transformation in Turkey over the past few years, and close listeners to this program should be well aware of this. That is to say that because Turkey has received a cold shoulder from the European Union, as it visibly admits countries like Croatia and Poland and Lithuania and all the rest, Turkey has come to the conclusion that perhaps it might be better off outside of the European Union. And certainly that seems to be the case. Its economy is expanding, and it's assumed a major importance in foreign relations as a bridge between, metaphorically, East and West. It's very sharply critical of Israel, which has improved its image in the Arab world. You might recall that episode some months ago when Mr. Erdogan at the Davos summit in Switzerland, where the elite come to meet and greet every January, he basically rebuffed in a violently rhetorical way Mr. Shimon Peres, one of Israel's leading politicians and figures.
You talked about that on these airways, I remember.
Absolutely, we
right.
did. So that's basically the story with regard to Turkey. Now, there's a footnote that I would add concerning its policy towards Syria. Initially, Mr. Erdogan had been quite friendly to Bashar al-Assad, but in light of this turmoil in Syria, he's turned rather sharply against the Syrian regime, condemning it for, quote, savagery, unquote, with regard to how it's dealing with its people. Mr. Erdogan needs to be careful with regard to that, because Turkey's record with regard to how they deal with the Kurdish minority is certainly not exemplary. And indeed, it seems to me that the situation with regard to the Kurdish minority in Turkey is a volcano waiting to explode. And I'm almost willing to bet on that happening sooner rather than later. Now, the Peruvian elections have already taken place. Mr. Humala, another leftist in a solid phalanx of leftist leaders in South America, has emerged triumphant. He has been known to be quite friendly to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, which is one of the reasons why the United States opposed him. I assume Canada opposed him as well. I assume Canada opposed him as well also because, as you know, Toronto is the heartbeat and the headquarters of a substantial mining industry.
That is correct.
And Peru has great amounts of silver, copper, and all of the rest. In fact, given the rise in copper prices, not least due to the Chinese economy booming, there has been more capital pouring into Peru. But one of the major election issues was the fact that capital was not trickling down, if you like, to the masses of the people. Peru remains a country that is definitely split, not only on class lines, but racial lines. That is to say that there's a massive indigenous population, and yet sitting at the top of the economic pyramid is a largely melanin-deficient population of descendants of European colonizers and conquistadors. There's also a smaller African population. Indeed, one of the rather quirky aspects about Peruvian culture is that the Peruvian elite, when they get buried, like to hire African pallbearers to take them to the thereafter, to the hereafter, for some strange reason that escapes me and eludes me. In any case, that news from Peru with regard to elections was quite positive and is indicative of which way the winds are blowing in the international community.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. I'm on the line with Dr. Gerald Horn. And could you spend a few moments? I have two supplementary questions. One, the question of Turkey and the whole question of the Islamic government. What is the difference between the government in Turkey and the government in Algeria? One, and then the second question is, could you talk about the various forms of socialism? Because I know you have, the Fabian socialism of someone like George Bernard Shaw, and we also have the scientific socialism of someone like Raul and Fidel Castro. Could you answer those two questions?
Well, historically, the dividing line between and among socialists had to do with who controlled the means of production. I mean, if you look at Scandinavian social democracy, for example, which is widely considered to be a form of socialism, you have private enterprise that is quite significant. I mean, look at IKEA, I-K-E-A, which I'm sure is in Canada, certainly all over the United States, or Volvo, which recently was bought up, actually, by a Chinese corporation, or Saab, another automobile manufacturer. But the difference with regard to a social democratic government is that they oftentimes tax heavily these private corporations and then use the taxes to develop social welfare programs, such as daycare programs, universal health care, for example, unemployment compensation. That is to say, if you don't have a job, you can receive a stipend from the government for X amount of weeks or months, perhaps even years. Now, in classical socialist countries, of which there are few in the world today, Cuba being one of the few examples remaining, basically the government controls, or the state controls, the state controls the economy. And private enterprise is sharply circumscribed. Now, one of the things that's happening in Cuba as we speak is a slight opening with regard to private enterprise, but this is mostly with regard to small business. For example, the ability of a party clown to hire out his or her services for children's birthday parties, that sort of thing.
Right.
So that's basically the dividing line between and amongst socialist governments. And, of course, you have the NDP in Canada, which I would assume is of the former variety as opposed to the latter variety. That is to say, closer to Scandinavian social democracy than to the kind of socialism practiced in Cuba.
Right.
Now, with regard to Turkey and Algeria, well, as you know, in Algeria, in northern Africa, over the past decade or more, they fought a violent conflict against the so-called Islamic guerrillas. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps, have been killed as a result. So it's difficult to say that the government that prosecuted that bloody conflict is sympathetic to any kind of Islamist sort of government. It's certainly not the kind of Islamist government that the guerrillas were trying to install. On the other hand, in Turkey, as noted, the AKP party is routinely described as mildly Islamist. That is to say that historically, at least since the end of World War I, approximately 90 years ago, and given the reforms of the founding father of modern Turkey, Kemal Atatürk or Mustafa Kemal, Turkey embarked upon a modernizing path and a republican path, and basically turned its back on religious displays in the public sphere. One of the conclusions that was drawn, perhaps inaccurately, from World War I and Turkey's devastating loss in World War I, where it lost basically the Ottoman Empire, an empire that ruled from North Africa into Central Asia, was that there should be a separation between religion and politics. Now, with the rise of the AKP party in recent years, that Atatürk premise has been challenged, and indeed that has infuriated many of the traditional elites, particularly in Istanbul, which is the commercial and, in a sense, political capital, although the actual capital is in Ankara. And that is one of the reasons you've had such significant interference in civilian affairs by the Turkish military. They've overthrown civilian governments more than once in recent years, and apparently, Mr. Erdogan has a hold on the military, and we should not expect any sort of coup against him going forward.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. I'm on the line with Dr. Gerald Horn. This is the last thing. In terms of the Turkish model, it seems to me that Malcolm X was attempting to do, it was separating. And he talked about, keep your religion in the home and in the closet. He was taking the path which I guess the people in Turkey took to a lesser extent, the people in Iraq under Saddam Hussein with the Ba'ath Party, and Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party, they were Sunni Muslims, but they sort of separated their religion from their politics. Am I correct in saying that?
Oh, that's a fair assumption.
And let us go on to talk about, we wanted updates, first of all, updates in Libya, Yemen, and Syria, those hot spots in the world.
Well, let's spend more than a moment on Libya, because I think at the end of the day, that future historians will conclude that this was a real turning point, not unlike the Suez conflict when Israel, Britain, and France jointly attacked Nasser's Egypt in 1956, which really not only was a stinging defeat inflicted upon these colonizers by this North African country, but also really signaled a shift in the correlation of forces globally. And so I think it's very important to pay close attention to what's going on in Libya. First of all, it's fair to say that there's a stalemate now. And I think that that stalemate has infuriated Washington in particular. You might have noted that the U.S. outgoing Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, made a stinging rebuke of NATO, of which Canada is a leading member, in a speech in Brussels in the last 24 hours, saying that its future was dim and dismal. And he pointed to the conflict in Libya, where he feels that the NATO partners are not stepping up to the plate. As he sees it, during the Cold War, the United States basically picked up 50% of the tab for NATO. Now it's picking up 75%. Here you have Britain and France leading this war on Libya, even though Britain is in the midst, supposedly, of cutting its military budget. Mr. Gates complained about the fact that they're almost running out of munitions in terms of their attack on Libya and had to go to the United States, basically, for emergency supplies of munitions. He's particularly critical of Germany, the economic locomotive of the European Union, and Poland, perhaps the most populous nation in Eastern Europe outside of Ukraine and Russia. And the German case is particularly telling because Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, the German leader, was just in Washington, and Mr. Obama was fawning all over her and gave her a 19-gun salute and awarded her the Medal of Freedom, one of this country's leading civilian honors. But she did not budge on getting involved in this Libyan conflict. And it's quite striking that Libya, which is a relatively small country, is still standing despite this massive bombing that's taking place. Now, in Abu Dhabi, just within the last 48 hours, you had a meeting of the anti-Gaddafi coalition led by the United States. I assume Canada had representation there.
Of course.
Kevin Rudd, the Australian foreign minister, who knows a thing or two about being ousted from government since he was the prime minister before falling victim to a palace coup, basically stated the conventional wisdom in the North Atlantic when he says that Gaddafi's days are numbered. But that may be whistling past the graveyard, because, as noted, there's a military stalemate that's taking place in Libya that seems that it will not be breaking anytime soon. At the same time, more and more is coming out about what might have led to this attack on Libya. Now, of course, the official story is protecting civilians, but Richard Haass, who's a former aide to Colin Powell, former U.S. Secretary of State, let the cat out of the bag some months ago when he said that that was piffle, basically, and that there was no prospect of some sort of Rwanda-style massacre, which is what we were told in the run-up to the United Nations passing these resolutions authorizing intervention in Libya. Not only that, but it's also emerged that Goldman Sachs, which is a major Wall Street firm, was in the midst of a major commercial difficulty with the Tripoli authorities to the tune of about $1 billion, and now with Gaddafi, at least in a stalemate and perhaps discredited, there's a prospect that Goldman Sachs will not have to pay that $1 billion with a B dollars and can add that to its bottom line. Mr. Gates, as noted, was praiseworthy of Canada. He says Canada has stepped up to the plate, you'll be happy to know, I'm sure. And he was also praiseworthy of Norway, the small Scandinavian country that's oil wealthy, even though it only has a population of about 4 million people, although the Norwegian government has announced that it'll be pulling out of this coalition in terms of the military aspect by August 1. Another telling aspect was the OPEC meeting, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries meeting, which is obviously and always an important gathering, that took place in Vienna just in this past week. And the Tripoli authorities were represented at the OPEC meeting, not the Benghazi authorities, which was quite telling. We had expected that the Tripoli government, that is to say the Gaddafi government, would not be represented, that their credentials would be challenged. That did not take place. This was telling also because this took place against the backdrop of an ongoing conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And for those of us who watch Press TV, which is Iran's English-language television network, it's been quite disconcerting in recent weeks to see the attacks on the Tripoli regime. And so we had expected that Iran would be united with Saudi Arabia and turning its back in the OPEC meeting against the Tripoli authorities, but that did not take place. And monitoring Press TV over the last 48 hours, I've noted a rhetorical shift that they're not as critical of the Tripoli authorities as they have been in recent months, and that might signal the fact that the Iranian authorities recognize they're next on the hit list.
Right.
That is to say that after knocking off Gaddafi at Tripoli and Mr. al-Assad in Damascus, that Mr. Ahmadinejad in Tehran is next. And so this was a defeat for the anti-Gaddafi coalition as it was a victory for the Tripoli authorities, just as it was a victory as well for Iran and Venezuela, the fact that oil production will be not necessarily increased, at least not by OPEC, although I noticed that right after the meeting when the Saudi initiative to raise production was defeated, the Saudis went on anyway and raised production. But I think we have to get used to the new normal of $100 a barrel for a barrel of petroleum, which means that the kind of prices you pay at the pump right now in North America will remain steady or go up. Certainly, I don't think you should expect them to be going down.
Right.
Now, a couple more points, if I may. The International Criminal Court, as you know, has also indicted Mr. Gaddafi, which
Right. Basically,
it seems to me, is a bad move all the way around, because that means it doesn't make sense for him to go into exile, because if he goes in exile, he'll wind up in The Hague on trial. And even if he does go in exile, he can look back at the example of Charles Taylor of Liberia, who accepted the bargain to go in exile, and
they got him anyway,
and they arrested him anyway. He's in The Hague as we speak. So all in all, I don't think that this Libyan conflict is going well for the North Atlantic powers. And there are a couple more points I could raise if you have time.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, one is that you might have noticed that the U.S. Congress had a vote on Libya, and it seems that there's a lot of discontent, not only in the Congress, but in terms of opinion polls with regard to this conflict. As noted last week, this is probably the most significant demerit on the record of Mr. Obama, because this was an unnecessary conflict. And it also turns out that, according to Mr. Gates, the U.S. Secretary of War, that this conflict in fiscal year 2011 will cost the United States taxpayers about $750 million, and it's heading northward at a rapid clip. And this at a time when unemployment is at record levels, when foreclosures on homeowners is at record levels, and all the rest. I think this Libyan conflict is basically revealing a fundamental rift between the United States on the one hand and its North Atlantic partners on the other. I think the fundamental problem is the United States has just gotten too much, 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 much too conservative, and that the North Atlantic countries basically have strong left social democratic and trade union movements. And I would say that compared to the United States, that also includes Canada. And that fundamental conflict is difficult to resolve as long as these conservatives are riding tall in the saddle here in the United States.
Right. And you wanted to talk about Yemen and Syria. Then we wanted to deal with the last point, with this who is Jinping?
Oh yes. Well, Syria, as you know, the situation is deteriorating. I mean, I've already made reference to the refugees flowing and fleeing into Turkey. Apparently, there's been a very bloody crackdown. There's talk about taking Mr. al-Assad now to The Hague and his confederates as well. The problem that the North Atlantic powers have with regard to Syria is the same conflict they did have in Libya, although they chose to ignore it, which is that what comes next after Mr. al-Assad? I mean, you may not like him, but as the saying goes, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. And there is some fear that if Mr. Al-Assad leaves, that the so-called Muslim Brotherhood will be rising to power. They already have established a beachhead in Cairo. And the same holds true for Yemen. You know that in the past week or so, President Saleh has gone into exile temporarily, he says, permanently, his opponents say. There was an attack on him in Sana'a. And what happened was that apparently the injuries inflicted upon him were much more severe than we were told initially. Apparently he had burns over a considerable part of his body. But in Yemen, the situation is rapidly deteriorating at a more rapid clip than even in Syria, not least because, number one, the civilian population is more heavily armed in Yemen than in Syria. And second of all, the economy is heading southward very quickly. That is to say, the country is not only running out of oil, it's running out of water. And as a matter of fact, Yemen might be the poster child for the water crisis, which this small planet will be grappling with for the rest of the century and beyond. So that's basically the case with regard to those three hotspots, Yemen, Syria, and Libya.
Now, who is Jean Ping? Is he from Gabon or from...
Well, you are correct as usual. Jean Ping is a Gabonese diplomat. He's the president of the African Union. And to that degree, he could be metaphorically described as the president of Africa. But the reason I raise this is I think listeners should know what might be considered either a trivial detail or a potent detail, depending on your point of view. And that is that just as Mr. Obama, the President of the United States, is of African and European descent, Jean Ping, the metaphorical President of Africa, is of African and Chinese descent. His father is Chinese. His father was a trader in Gabon. Mother is African. And in any event, as I said, depending on your point of view, you can either find that trivial or potent.
Well, you know, I did a little research, and one thing that always fascinated me was I grew up, and one of the first authors that I read was J.A. Rogers, and he wrote this book called 100 Amazing Facts About the Negro with Complete Proof. And Mr. Rogers always talked about, one of the things that I found fascinating was that there was a guy by the name of Eugene Chin, who was Trinidadian, and he is I don't know if this was politically correct, but when I came to Canada, I used to hear people talk about Chigros, and a Chigro is a Chinese and a Negro, and Eugene Chin was from Trinidad, and he went back to China and became in Sun Yat-sen's government, and I think in 1927, he actually had a government post. What do you know about Eugene Chin?
Well, you're correct. Not only that, but if I'm not mistaken, he had a daughter, or at least a close relative, who was very close to Langston Hughes.
I don't know about that aspect.
Black American writer,
right.
Poet, and playwright. In fact, Langston Hughes writes quite a bit about her. She was a well-known dancer and performer and cultural worker. And in fact, this close relationship with Chin's daughter, if I'm not mistaken, has always been a challenge to those analysts who have suggested that Langston Hughes was strictly a gay male.
Right.
So, but in any case, I'm quite familiar with Eugene Chin, and I think what it bespeaks is the Chinese diaspora, and just like you had this Indian diaspora, which those of us who are familiar with Guyana and Trinidad are familiar with, there's likewise a Chinese diaspora. For example, when the African slave trade was coming under attack in Cuba in the middle of the 19th century, the Spanish authorities started arranging basically what amounted to a Chinese slave trade coming from southern China. And historically, there had been a major Chinese population as a result in Cuba, and then they began to disperse after the 1959 revolution, although there's still a considerable Chinese population there. I recall when I first moved to New York in the 1970s, there were a spate of Chinese-Cuban restaurants on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Most of them had disappeared. I often wonder what happened to the proprietors. But in any case, there is a substantial and considerable Chinese diaspora, which, of course, is also present in Africa. And I should mention in that context that your old friend, Hillary Rodham Clinton, is in Zambia as we speak.
She's in Zambia? Okay.
And she began almost from the moment she touched down in Lusaka, issuing a tirade against the Chinese presence in Africa, which, of course, is quite a bugaboo for the North Atlantic community. They're so, so concerned that the Africans will be exploited by China. And that's one of my interlocutors when this issue arose. Whatever China does, I doubt if it'll sink to the depths of the African slave trade, responsible for the presence of so many millions on these shores of North America. But in any case, I think that's a very telling signal, that this ongoing hysteria about the Chinese role in Africa.
And I guess I would like to mention, I guess we have an Indo, an Indian governor. Is he still the governor of Louisiana? Very right wing, changed his name. I think he's Bobby Gentile, I guess.
Right.
Would he be Hindu or do you know his
Well, he's
a Catholic now.
Catholicism,
right, he's a Catholic,
In order to fit in better in Louisiana, which,
right,
as you know, was the recipient of a major diaspora from Quebec in the 18th century after the British defeat of the French in 1763. And they brought their Roman Catholicism with them, that is to say, speaking of that Quebecois population. And he also changed his name to Bobby. That was not the name he was given. He named himself after a character in a situation comedy on television. And you are correct to say that he's very right-wing. I mean, he's bad news. Indeed, however, that means that he is highly qualified to become a leader of the United States of America, I'm afraid.
Right. And the last thing is, I was born in Arcadia, Louisiana. And it was, I was born in the woods, but the street is Marcellus Street, so that speaks to that whole French question, although I don't know. I don't claim any French, but, I know all about that French situation. Last question is, it looks like to me that the press is going to town on the fact that the Dallas Mavericks may win the championship, and it looks as if they are going against the slave revolt, which was LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh. I think they staged the slave revolt when they came up with their own, when they decided to play together. And it looks as if it was all right when the bosses put together Boston, when they brought in Kevin Garnett and what's the other brother? Ray Allen.
Joined Paul Pierce.
To join Paul Pierce, that the bosses did that. That was fine. But when the slaves, the enslaved Africans, LeBron James and the Wade and Bosch come together, that is treason. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're hitting the nail on the head. I think one of the most sensitive racial come class frontiers that we encounter in North America is in professional sports. And that's why it's more than frivolity. It's more than just a game. Because when you have this rather potent combination of these men of African descent, many of whom are descendants of slaves, actually in this case all of them being so, basically being multimillionaires and then being able to control their own destinies by, as you know, joining together in Miami, that outrages and infuriates so many, and even those who should know better get outraged and infuriated.
All right.
So it's quite a spectacle that's unfolding with regard to these basketball championships.
All right. Any predictions as to who are you? Are you still staying with Miami?
I'm going down with the ship.
All right. So we will be back in contact with you next week.
All right, take care.
And we will see you in the whirlwind. We're getting, thank you. We have been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn.